All right, Allison.
All right, see the extended remix of the 3-minute highlights you gave last week. And I did want to spend some time talking about the simulations, even though that's a whole other like 30 to 45 minute talk in itself, just to introduce you guys to it briefly. So the code that I'm going to be using here today is Gasoline. Gasoline started off as PKD grav in its n-body only days, and then gas got added in the form of smooth particle hydrodynamics. So all of these types of physics are included, including a uniform UV background that we turn on at redshift 6 that mimics reionization. And once you add gas, of course, that gas has to get cold and dense and go on and form stars, and those stars have to go supernova. And so I wanted to at least introduce one slide on our feedback scheme, because it's sort of the thing that's responsible for what we consider to be the successes of our model. So historically, feedback has been an issue in disk galaxy simulations, because a star particle goes supernova, it dumps its energy into the surrounding gas medium. That medium is really dense, so it just radiates all of that energy away very quickly, and as if the supernova never happened. So one way to fix that, at least historically, has just been to shut off cooling in the nearest neighbors around a star particle in SPH simulations. And because this is SPH, you pick just 32 nearest neighbors and turn it off for some period of time. Well, Greg Stinson a couple years ago modified our feedback scheme in our code, and we still turn off cooling in these particles, but now we actually try to model it based on what we think we know about supernovae physics. So in other words, based on the Sudhoff-Taylor solution. So we can actually calculate the blast radius, and if several supernovae go off at once, you can actually grow your blast radius and get bubbles. And so what you see here are, this is an image from one of our simulations, and you can see that we have these bubbles in our ISM that look very similar to the bubbles that you see in the H1 distribution in real galaxies. And the time also that we turn off the cooling for is now also modeled based on that, on the Sudhoff-Taylor solution.
But there's no motions in the gas, right? You just shut off the cooling for a specified volume that depends on the saturation rate and the local densities.
Say that one more time.
You're not actually including velocities in the gas. You just
right,
shut
it's
the
thermal.
For a while, you
right.
Let the thing overpressurize, and then the whole thing will blow
sure.
up and so on.
It's true, yep. Okay. So this shows you the formation, the results from one of these simulations for the formation of a Milky Way mass galaxy. What you're seeing here is just a gas density map, basically. And you'll start to see blue and red lights go off here in the center. Those are star particles forming, and they're color-coded based on their age and their metallicity. So you can see this gas streaming in along these filaments at early times as the galaxy forms here. And I say this is a Milky Way mass galaxy. I wouldn't call this a Milky Way-like galaxy, because this galaxy actually has a very active merger history, unlike what we think has happened to our own Milky Way. And the neat thing about this is that even though it keeps undergoing merger after merger, these mergers are all gas-rich, and so we actually keep reforming a disk every time. So I can just let this play for a little bit.
So,
yeah, so you can
the,
see like the disk reforming here after this.
What are the gas fractions typically?
Chris, can you help me out?
Dependent.
I mean, they're
no,
they're.
Images.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the, like how much? Like,
there's more gas than stars.
Okay.
Like 1:1 or something.
I think a bit more, but it depends. It's mass dependent.
Mm-hmm.
You see how tiny the disk was at the beginning. It's where that's
and now,
those making the morning. So the rip really small. You don't form really things at 10 kiloparsecs.
Well, you do by redshift 1. I'm going to show you actually later. So anyway, quick highlights from our simulations, things that we think we're doing successfully now, lots of it based on our supernova feedback scheme. At redshift 0, we do think we have a realistic luminosity, satellite luminosity function, meaning we get tens of satellites around a Milky Way mass halo, not hundreds. We produce the observed trend in downsizing, and by downsizing here, we're talking about the average age of the stellar population. So,
before you go on,
yeah.
You say you observe tens instead
yes.
of hundreds.
Yes.
So some recent estimates said there actually should be hundreds around.
Yeah, and there we have dark halos, right?
Most no. They were saying that actually would be hundreds of luminosities.
Oh, right. We don't resolve down to that mass limit that we're going to see things that small forming stars in our simulations. Right, so I couldn't.
The mass. What is the mass of a particle in gas?
About 10 to the 5.
So the smallest thing you find is the 10 to the 7th, right, in solar masses.
Right.
That's, you know, 4 next legs, right? Not
going to go below. Sure, but our the supernova, sorry, the star formation breaks down unless you've got several thousands of particles inside of the virial radius. So the star formation rate actually converges if you've got more than several thousand, meaning you're not actually going to see enough star formation in those little things to get stars. We just don't have the resolution to do it.
So the tens of them you see are all very massive.
Fairly.
There's not tens of satellites with the mass.
Yeah, they're not tens.
I don't mean like tens of Fornaxes. I just mean like, you know. I'm not going to touch this because I'm not going to argue that it's an actual luminosity function.
So. Similar things, and with that type of resolution, you will probably see 2 or 3 satellites.
No, we do see about 10 things. But they're not. They range from around 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 9. We've got one LMC galaxy, that sort of thing. So whether or not I'm not saying it's absolutely accurate. I'm just saying we get a lot of dark halos. We get something that's somewhat realistic.
And I'm sure you probably see a different feedback scheme, and so that probably just depends very sensitively on the.
Right, but you can check your observations.
That's so realistic to put.
There's like LMC.
Reasonable.
All right.
Fair enough, but the fact that the simulations don't agree, that's probably attributable to
it. Okay.
It's not really established yet that there are dark halos.
Right.
that would normally host stars, you know, like
No.
I think you were saying that there is dark halos even at those.
No. That's not actually what I'm trying to say. Sorry. I'd have to look into it further, but I'm not trying to say they're all 10 to the 9 dark. I'm saying things around, with a circular velocity of around 30 is where you start to suppress star formation, and below 10 to 15, they're all dark. So, all right.
So may I have a question about downsizing?
Yes.
Which particular flavor
of downsizing? So that's what I was trying to get to here, which is that by that I just mean that on average, the lower mass objects have a younger stellar population than the high mass objects. And that's because of our feedback scheme. The feedback is efficient at regulating star formation so that it's got more of an effect in the low potential wells of the small mass objects. So you get a lower star formation rate in these things. It's delayed. And so you end up getting a younger, on average, stellar population.
Connected to that, when did you assemble your objects? I mean, are the massing objects assembly earlier than low mass objects, or the other way around?
It depends on your definition of assembled, I guess. Or
say when they grow up to half of their mass?
I don't know. I don't think about formation time as a half of a mass thing. So, yeah. So we can follow. What I end up doing is just following the most massive progenitor of the halo back to redshift 6. So I don't know when it doubled in its mass.
I mean, they've chosen a few dwarfs and they've chosen a few Milky Way sized halos. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you can't really do a statistic. So
no, that's the other thing.
The dwarfs have collapsed earlier by any reasonable definition.
Right.
It's just what makes.
But their star formation is delayed.
Yeah.
I have another question about your modeling. Are you allowing star formation in satellite?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you model the cooling on the satellite?
Same way that cooling the big one.
So you just consider it,
It's all there. It's all the same. It's the same simulation.
Okay. So here's the big one here. The granddaddy of all problems in disk galaxy formations, the angular momentum catastrophe. We think we're actually doing a pretty good job of overcoming the angular momentum catastrophe and landing on the Tully-Fisher relationship. Do they have the room reserved? Okay. And finally, we matched the observed mass-metallicity relationship for galaxies both at redshift 0, redshift 2, and redshift 3. And so what I'm showing here are images for three of our simulated galaxies observed with Patrick Janssen's Sunrise Code. This is an image that Chris put together. So three simulated galaxies and three real galaxies from SDSS, trying to convince you that actually our simulated galaxies are starting to look more like real disk galaxies. So. All right. So, huh?
Even dust.
Well, it's the dust in sunrises is treated as a function of the metallicity of the gas particles. So, any more questions on the simulations before I move on to actually the science? Okay. All right, so I'm going to be talking about cold flow gas accretion. And the background here is that in the simplest picture of galaxy formation, when a halo collapses, as the dark matter virializes, it shock heats all of the gas to the virial temperature of the halo. And then any subsequently accreted gas is then also raised to the virial temperature of the halo as it enters. And this is shown really nicely here in this spherical model from Deco and Birnbaum, at just a spherical simulation where they're growing a Milky Way mass galaxy at the center. And these are different shells of gas that eventually flow onto the galaxy. So they're initially part of the Hubble expansion, and then they turn around. And as they enter the virial radius, you can see that there's a discontinuity here as the gas shocks as it enters the virial radius. And the shock radius and the virial radius are well matched. But this is the adiabatic case, meaning there's no cooling in this gas. So what happens if you turn on cooling? Well, then you get a different picture where, at early times, the gas is actually allowed to flow through the virial radius and doesn't shock until it reaches the high densities at the disk. It's not for some amount of time, then, as this galaxy starts growing, that a shock is capable of developing, and eventually the shock radius again matches the virial radius out here. And the reason that's happening is because you have to compare the compression rates here from the infalling gas and compare that to the cooling rates in the halo of that galaxy. And at these times, when the galaxy is still too low mass, the cooling times are very fast, and so all the gas can just cool onto the disk very quickly. But as this thing gets more massive, it's capable of developing a standing shock, and you end up developing a hot halo around this galaxy. Okay. So I'm not the first person to look at this in SPH simulations. Dushan Karas also did this. And these are just a sample of particles from his simulation where, so this is the phase diagram where in red here you can see that particles start off cold and dense, low densities in the intergalactic medium. Then some of them follow the standard case here where they reach very high temperatures and are eventually allowed to cool into the disk of the galaxy. But he also found this subset of particles that never get shock heated to the virial temperature. And so part of this is due to that case I just showed you for low mass galaxies. And this is already also in the semi-analytic models where for low mass galaxies, the cooling times are longer than the free fall time, shorter than the free fall time. And so the gas just falls in on the free fall time to the galaxy disk. But Dushan also found that, in fact, even when galaxies had a hot halo, you could still get cold gas accretion along filaments that were penetrating inside of the galaxy's virial radius. And so this is actually what I'm going to be more interested in today, is the filaments. So I tried to do this. When Dushan did this, he's looking at a large cosmological volume. So he's got hundreds or thousands of galaxies in this box. And I'm taking the opposite approach, where I'm going to show you four galaxies today. But my four galaxies have very high resolution. They all have more than a million particles within the virial radius by redshift zero, whereas Dushan, because he had such a large box, you sacrifice resolution on any individual galaxy, and he couldn't tell you what happened to the disk after the galaxy accreted this gas. So when Dushan did it, he simply divided gas into hot and cold accretion based on this temperature cutoff here. So anything above 2.5 times 10 to the 5 Kelvin got labeled as hot shocked gas. And the reason he did that, and these are now actually plots from one of my simulations for Milky Way, is that if you look at the temperature history of the accreted gas, and so what we're looking at here is gas that gets accreted between redshift 6 and redshift 4, between redshift 4 and redshift 3, redshift 3 and redshift 2, et cetera, you can see that there's this bimodal distribution. And so there's this dip here. And the reason, however, for this dip has to do with the physics of the cooling curve and not actually with the physics of gas accretion onto galaxies. So I wanted to try to do this differently because I have these four galaxies. I can get the virial temperature at every time step and tell you what the gas is doing in relation to the virial temperature. Okay. So the first way I could try to do this is just simply based on this temperature, look for shocked gas or hot gas based on some sort of fraction of the virial temperature. And this, I just chose this straight out of Birnbaum and Deckel, where if gas shocks as it enters the virial radius, it should reach 3/8 of the virial temperature. The problem here is in the low mass case, because of our uniform UV background, because of reionization, the temperatures in the IgM are actually hotter than 3/8 of the virial temperature for those low mass halos. And so, and this is sort of like that low mass case for the semi-analytic models as well. I had to impose a minimum halo mass where you can start shocking. So in other words, another way of saying it is the entropy of these low mass halos is less than the entropy floor of the IgM. So I introduced an entropy cutoff where a halo has to be at some entropy. So if a gas particle enters the virial radius and undergoes a strong shock, then its density should increase by a factor of 4, and it should reach 3/8 of the virial temperature of the halo. So if the halo has this minimum mass, and the particle reaches this minimum mass, and it reaches high temperatures, then I call it shocked. Okay. But this now allows me to find the gas that actually gets heated in a hot halo, and the particles that never reach, that don't meet these criteria, are coming in along these filaments as cold, dense gas. Okay, so let's actually get to some results here. Except ignore the green part for right now. So the stuff underneath the green is a gas density map. Yeah, I know, it's everywhere. The stuff underneath, though, is just a gas density map showing you the growth of a Milky Way mass halo in the simulations. So redshift 4, redshift 3, redshift 1. And so you can see, in fact, that there's these filaments of gas coming in and feeding this Milky Way galaxy at the center here. But what you can also see is that never marked in green are these other little halos. Okay, so when I'm considering gas that gets shocked or not shocked, I'm throwing out everything that comes in from other halos. So I don't even want to consider that. I call that clumpy gas accretion, and I don't consider it any further. So then, back to the stuff in green, what I'm showing you here on the left-hand side in green are particles that come in but never approach the virial temperature of the galaxy, whereas over on the right-hand side are gas particles that come in and reach very high temperatures. In other words, shocked or unshocked, as I've labeled them here.
So green and green.
Yes. So this is gas, for instance, that is will eventually be accreted to the galaxy and not reach high temperatures as it is accreted. And this stuff is stuff that will be accreted but reach high temperatures.
Over all time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
No,
there's an obvious difference, right? Where this cold gas is coming in mostly along these filaments. And the shocked gas actually has a much more uniform distribution. So that's the first thing you should notice. The other thing I like to, the reason I like this image, so by the way, black is the virial radius of that galaxy at each of these times. And so I guess it's hard to see here, but at redshift 4, this galaxy isn't quite massive enough yet to develop a hot halo. And so it doesn't have any really shocked accretion inside of the virial radius, or no green marked particles. Whereas all of this cold gas is being accreted along these filaments at redshift 4. But by redshift 3, it's already massive enough to support a stable shock, which means that you get all of this hot gas accretion, but you also get, at the same time, still a lot of cold gas coming in along these filaments.
So on the right-hand side, you've got all these green points outside the virial radius.
Mm-hmm. So So I trace the entire history of a gas particle and follow it as it enters the virial radius and as it approaches the disk and say, does it ever reach basically those high temperatures, 3/8 of the virial temperature?
So are you saying that those particles outside have been shocked or they will be shocked?
Everything inside the virial radius has been accreted and been shocked. Everything outside will be accreted and be shocked. Yeah.
Why does is equal to one picture that looks so similar?
That's a lot of the gas accretion has already occurred by that point. Yeah. Yeah, the gas accretion rates tail off with time. In fact, I'll show that in the next slide.
Wait, and that's not it.
Huh?
In the left here, the bottom left, that's everything is seen green. Never was shocked, but it looks like it's very on everything.
It doesn't look like filaments anymore. What's going on?
Well, you still have, some of it can still be in the halo here, right? So this isn't necessarily that it's in the disk, but it's been accreted and it may later cool onto the disk. It's just a snapshot of where that gas is. So it can still be in the halo and later cool onto the disk.
The peak is saturated too.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can see that even in the Redshift 3 case and in the Redshift 4 case, you know, where the filaments are converging, it sort of gets something that ends up looking less filamentary, but it's way inside the bureau radius.
How much cool gas do you have in any case, both in the shuttle and the shuttle?
So I did this for four galaxies, spanning two orders of magnitude in virial mass. And so this one, so 3 times 10 to the 10, here's about an LMC-sized galaxy, Milky Way, and 3 times Milky Way. And so this lowest mass galaxy here, so blue here, is the gas that gets smoothly accreted, in other words, it's never belonged in another galaxy halo, and it remains cold as it gets accreted. And so this low mass halo here is never actually massive enough to support a stable shock, so all of its gas accretion comes in cold. And you can see that there's a strong trend then with the amount of shock gas with halo mass.
You're using cold and unshocked.
I am, sorry. It's a bad habit of mine, but yes, I am using them interchangeably. Because it's basically a temperature criterion that I used. And so it's really cold versus not. But I tend to have a bad habit of saying shocked versus not as well. Or other way around. Right. And so the green is the stuff that comes in from other halos as clumpy accretion, and the red is the fraction of gas that came in smoothly accreted but reached high temperatures. Okay. And so this shows the gas accretion rates, which is kind of bad coloring. But again, the blue is the gas that came in and never reached high temperatures. The green is the gas that came in as clumpy accretion. And the red is the gas that reaches high temperatures, approaching the virial temperature. And so you can see for this galaxy, it's not massive enough to support a stable shock until about redshift of a half. But the interesting part is these two, Milky Way mass galaxy and 3 times Milky Way mass, where most of the gas accretion history is actually dominated by this hot gas accretion. Mm-hmm. All right, so now we're getting to the real point. I was more interested in what happened to this gas after its accretion. What impact do these cold gas accretion have in building the stellar disk? And so what I'm showing you here, again, is that same plot for the gas accretion rates, and down here, the disk star formation rates, where I can follow, now that I know all the gas particles that came in cold, I can find the star particles that came from those parent gas particles and look at the disk star formation rate. So I've specifically cut out the disk at redshift 0 and asked about the history of those star particles. And so the interesting part here.
When you say cut out the disk, you mean? It's a, the particles in the galaxy,
it's a kinematic decomposition where it's actually similar to a body at all, where you pick.
So it's just things that more go around in circles.
They're mostly circular orbits, yeah. Okay. So the interesting part is these two more massive galaxies where their gas accretion rates are actually dominated mostly by this hot gas accretion. But if you look at the star formation rate in the disk, in particular for this Milky Way mass galaxy, its disk star formation rates are instead dominated by this cold gas accretion. And even for this more massive galaxy here, it's got an early burst of star formation in the disk that's due entirely to this cold gas accretion. And only later does the hot gas is it able to cool under the disk and form stars. Okay, so the reason that this is interesting, at least to me, is because historically, when people have tried to do analytic disk models of models of disk formation, they have a hard time growing large disks until after redshift 1. And so I've just marked here on this plot where redshift 1 is, and you can see that there's substantial star formation in the disk prior to redshift 1. And in fact, if I image this galaxy using sunrise at redshift 1, this is the rest frame BBAM image of this galaxy. You can see that there's already a large disk in place at redshift 1, and it's due to this cold flow gas accretion. At redshift 1, I don't know.
Yeah. What is
Green is the green is stuff that came from clumpy gas accretion. It was so gas accreted and merges.
It's like two solar masses per year for 5 gigayears, right?
Or six, yeah. And this is good, right? It's good if it's big, because there's all this evidence, actually, that there are massive disks already in place at redshift 1. So this is just a list of a whole bunch of it. And down here, the last three references I've got here are from the Symphony team, which is now finding massive disks in place at redshift 2, even. So I wanted to try to see what effect it would have on these disks if all that gas had actually reached the virial temperature of the halo. And so what I'm showing here in black is just the same thing I just showed you, the disk star formation rates, where now I've just summed the shocked, the unshocked, and the clumpy all together into one as the solid line. But there's a delay in the simulations, right? So as a gas particle enters the virial radius, there's some time it takes to cool onto the disk, and then it may actually sit in the disk for a little while before it goes on to form stars. And so I measured that time delay, so between entering the virial radius and forming stars in the disk, for the cold gas populations and for the hot gas. And it turns out it's substantially different. So the cold gas reaches the disk and forms stars within 1 to 2 billion years. The hot gas takes around 5 billion years to go to the disk and form stars. And so I just said, what happened if I add that delay time onto all the star from the formation times of all the star particles that form from cold gas and remake this plot? And that's what I'm showing here as the dotted line. So if the cold gas had behaved like the hot gas and taken a long time to form stars, then you would have substantially delayed star formation in this disk until after redshift 1.
So cold gas is just basically being delivered directly into the sort of belly of the beast, whereas the hot gas is actually, it's just the cooling time.
Yep.
Right, so you're effectively just saying, you erase the filament and let it all be spherically accreted.
Exactly. It's my way of trying to mimic what would happen if it was a spherical accretion model.
Right. So you could never get a massive disk at redshift 1 this way without the filaments. Is that the right point?
I mean, that's what this tells me. Maybe the modelers would say something different. I don't know. Actually, how much time do we have? I can stop here, actually, unless you want to keep going. But I was going to extend this to massive galaxies at high redshift. So,
well, I'm running, but people should feel free to.
Okay. So here's another movie, at least, of a massive galaxy at. So I wanted to do this for these are. This is a galaxy that will become a small cluster at redshift 0. Where we've only run this to redshift 4 because. The point here is to get 1 million particles within the virial radius by redshift 4. So they're the same resolution as the disk galaxies I just showed you, but they're incredibly high resolution, so you have to, for computational purposes, stop at redshift 4. It's too expensive to keep running them. But you can see here, so this is 30 kiloparsecs on a side, but there's all this cold gas streaming in to feed this galaxy at the center here.
These are filaments. Also of dark matter? I mean, is it going
There's no dark matter shown in this movie, but yeah, I mean, the gas coming in filaments is generally part of dark matter, yeah. Dark matter streams. I don't know about that.
So
this will turn into basically a small cluster. So this is different now. This will end up being, you know, something red and elliptical by redshift 0. But I stop it at redshift 4 where it's still actively star forming. So I did that for 3 of these galaxies that turned into small clusters. Here's that same bar plot showing you that they've been dominated by cold, unshocked gas accretion, at least to redshift 4. And I'm just going to try to hurry through this a little bit quickly so I can get you guys out of here. But here again are the gas accretion rates where I've just highlighted the axes here so that you can compare them to the star formation rates. And you can see that in no case are the star formation rates 1-to-1. And that's, again, because of our feedback scheme where you're regulating, even though you're getting this lots and lots of cold gas being built up in these galaxies, you're getting a cold gas reservoir. When star formation turns on, the supernovae regulate that star formation, and so you end up getting lower star formation rates.
And these are their masses at redshift 0, or these are
No, at redshift 4 where we stop them.
Your 10th and 12th solar mass halo is not really super dominated by shocked hot gas.
Right. It looks like it will be at starting at or about redshift 4, but. I think this is just. I just wanted to point out. Then you can see the green, if you can see it. Really, the spikes in the green indicate where a major merger has happened. And so you can see here, for instance, there's a big major merger. But if you look at the star formation rates over here, we don't get mergers in bursts. What happens is you've got two. Actually, this is partly based on the way I've defined things. So I followed the main progenitor back all the way to high redshift. So even when you get a major merger, that slightly less massive galaxy that merges, I call clumpy accretion. And so you really effectively end up with two things that are also having big cold gas reservoirs merging together at high redshift here. And so you end up with just a lot more fuel for star formation, and your star formation rates go up.
But that subsequent star formation rate would go in the green line, not in the blue line. Because that.
You could think about it that way, yeah.
That came from the two.
You could think about it that way, yeah. But I would argue, right? No, but see, here's my argument, is that the green stuff here should be blue. Because it's two massive galaxies that have both been accreting mostly cold gas along these filaments.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would, yeah, I would twist it the other way. And I just wanted to point out, this is my final slide, actually, that the star formation rates of these galaxies we see here are comparable to what we see for Lyman Break galaxies at high redshift. And I add this question, top of the IMF, because some models have had to add, in order to reproduce the observed colors of massive galaxies at high redshift, have had to add a top-heavy IMF. But these things are actually reaching very high metallicities already by redshift 4. So here I've got it listed as about minus 1, but that's actually considering all of the cold gas in the galaxy. If you just look at the central portions where there's stars, it's even higher than that. It's approaching solar. So just wanted to point that out. So there you go. I'm done.
And that's to make them blue. So actually, if it's solar, you know, typically the way to get out of making them blue at redshift 2 or 3 is, you know, you've got like an HB phase, which, you know, at low metallicity gets a lot of blue stuff. So you're saying that that's not going to work for these types, if you have an accretion history like the ones that you're showing.
I'm just saying, and I don't know, this could be, I don't know if this is useful or not, but I'm just saying that they're reaching very high metallicity, so they could be very dusty. They've got high red star formation rates. And so they might be redder. I don't know. I haven't imaged these things. The things I'd like to do then is to image this with sunrise and see what the colors are.